You know, we've been talking over the course of the last couple of days about kind of issues reporting on veterans and high-impact stories and all this. And along the way, we've had some, I think, very wise advice and a lot of insight, both from the panel and from you guys, that touched on interviewing. And what I want to do in this particular time is have a conversation that drills down a little more deeply on this very challenging subject. You know, interviewing veterans who, as we know from this morning, carry with them a different military culture. Interviewing veterans who we know from yesterday are carrying around the psychological sequelae of sometimes extreme situations and events. Interviewing women veterans who have faced military sexual trauma. Interviewing perpetrators. All of these issues have come up in passing through the day and through the weekend. What I propose to you is that we're really talking about special interview skills that challenge some of our basic presumptions and basic toolkits as journalists. I think that most of what we know how to do as reporters, both what we formally may learn in journalism programs and what we informally learn on the job about interviewing, really has to do with interviewing people who have a fair amount of power. I could take anyone in this room and put you into a White House press conference and you would know what to do. I could take any of you and send you down to the Philadelphia police station, say interview the chief of police, and you would know what to do. Or a corporate briefing or an interview with Warren Buffett. We know how to talk to people who have power. We know how to talk to people who have a sense of on the record and off the record, who understand the role of the press in some sense, and whose own experiences by definition are part of the news. We are less skilled as a tribe at interviewing and telling the stories of people who don't have power. And I think that when you're talking about combat veterans, let alone women who've endured military sexual trauma, as with other deeply traumatized populations, you're talking about people who, whatever their initial authority and status in life, have experienced a radical loss of power. When your life is threatened by enemy fire, when your buddies are blown up next to you, when you are raped, you're experiencing a radical loss of power. And this challenges our toolkit. Most of our interviewing skills are designed to take power away from those whom we interview. We want to keep people on the record as long as we can. We want to get in the door where the door is slammed in our face, all that sort of thing. But as we heard, I think, most poignantly yesterday from Helen Benedict, but I think has been reflected in some of the other things folks have said, in so many cases here, we're talking about a different kind of a power shift, where in order to earn trust, in order to build a relationship that can result in a story, we need to, in ways that make us uncomfortable, give up some of our power, some of our authority. We talked yesterday about having our sources review our quotes or even our whole stories. This is a huge, scary thing for most of us, giving up that kind of power. Other kinds of power shifts. I think that underscores a lot of what we've been talking about on interviewing. But we are lucky to still have Paul Kennedy, Paul Sullivan and Kelly Kennedy. Both,
I'm married to her,
both, yes. Good County Kerry names, I should say, where my wife's family is also from, with us because they can take different perspectives. Both of them are veterans. Paul is also an advocate and friend of journalists, and Kelly is a journalist. And Matt, Kelly, why don't we start with you? You know, you've been a soldier, and now you interview soldiers. What is that like, and what do you think reporters need to understand in order to bridge that gap that you have to daily bridge in your own mind?
You know, on my website, I've got a website for the guys in the book, and I posed this question to them: What should I be telling these journalists? And it was funny because when they were sending their suggestions, it was the same stuff I came out of Desert Storm thinking, and it was, we're not cogs in a machine, we're people. It drove me crazy when I was in the military to see stories that made it look like I was just like everybody else. And unthinking, you know, part of the unthinking group, they did say, tell the good stories too, just like your PAs will tell you. And like I was saying earlier with Hope, that's important as well. But the biggest thing for them seemed to be just to get it right. And this is something that I talk about a lot. I don't want to be an advocate necessarily. But telling stories helps these guys heal. That's the therapy for post-traumatic stress is to tell your story, to tell it over and over again until it just doesn't hurt as much to tell it. And part of that is getting it right. If I tell a veteran's story and I don't have it right, it makes it worse. So I think there's a lot of things that go into that, and one of them is giving a lot of time for these interviews. If you're going to talk to someone about something that's traumatic, let them talk. Most of the time you don't have to say... I find that I don't usually have to say what specifically happened on this date that brought you around to this. It usually starts out with a conversation where I say, so tell me what happened, what was your tour like? And if they trust you and if you give them time, they'll tell you eventually what it is you need to know. Getting back to the accuracy thing, though, if you don't know what an IED is, if you don't know what a FOBET is, if you don't understand something, ask them, and don't be afraid to ask them, because if you do ask them and they can explain it again, they understand that you really want to know. So that's a good thing. One of the things that surprised me, even after being in the military and after going to Iraq and seeing some really bad things, some of these guys have brain injuries, which means short-term memory loss, which means you set up an appointment and they don't come. So I've learned to call them 15 minutes before and say, hey, you remember we're doing this today, right? And not to get upset about it, and to make sure that I don't embarrass them when I call them, because they get, if you joke, they're going to be fine. But if you call and you're angry because they're late for the appointment, they're going to feel like crap, and that's going to be horrible. Their storytelling skills will be different if they're suffering from short-term memory loss. If you ask them a question and they need to get to that specific answer, they may need to tell the whole story again to get to that point in the story, to remember it. Give them a lot of time. And if you shut them down on that, if you say, no, I just need to know this part, you could end up with a very frustrated veteran who never can give you the answer. So definitely if you're dealing with a traumatic brain injury, keep that in mind, the short-term memory loss. And the other part of that is if you shut someone down as they're telling those stories, Even for me, coming back from Iraq for the series, for the book, I started to tell my dad about some of the things I saw and saw it on his face that he just couldn't listen. So I stopped telling him. And I saw it over and over and over again. And because I'm me, that doesn't really shut me down. Nothing's going to shut me down. But a lot of the veterans, they'll stop telling those stories because they get used to seeing that look. They get used to being shut down. You guys are storytellers. If you can let them tell the whole story, that can be very healing for them. And it's different. It's different from what you would do with, you know, a politician. You end up having to shut them down. With veterans, it helps if you can give them room to talk. And if you can ask them those questions, if you can educate your communities about that, about how important it is to let people tell their stories, that's a big thing, too. Jonathan Shea in his book talks about how in the old days, people would come back from wars and it'd be a community event. And everyone would sit down and listen to the stories and everyone knew what was going on. And we're not doing that for our veterans now. Well, if there's anyone who can do that for our veterans now, good stories, bad stories, any stories, they don't even care if you tell their bad stories as long as you tell them well. It's you guys, so.
Paul, what are your thoughts? You're the kind of in the broker position a lot of time, but what would be your do's and don'ts to start off with?
Kelly said something really important I want to reemphasize. For veterans who are sharing their stories, they're looking for recovery from TBI or PTSD. They're looking to reintegrate into the community or readjust. And that means that somewhere in the story you need the hope. You need the silver lining. And just to show of hands, who here has seen the movie The Best Years of Our Lives? Oh, man, I'm so happy to see any hands. Okay? Here's my big ask. Okay? All right, I'm a sentimental guy. Please, on your list of things to do, the movie is called The Best Years of Our Lives. It's poignant, but it's also inspirational. It discusses the lives of three veterans coming home from World War II, and it is timeless. Without saying PTSD, you witness a veteran getting up in the middle of the night with issues. That movie came out in 1946, and it helped America understand the 12 million vets coming home. So really what I try to say in a practical matter is to understand there's really three phases of an interview with a vet: the pre-interview, the interview, and the post-interview. And before I get to that, just full disclosure, I am a Gulf War veteran, if I skipped over that earlier. Yes, I was in the invasion in 1991, and I was a scout in an infantry battalion. And yes, I was there seeing a lot of combat and a lot of people dying, getting shot at, all that kind of crazy shit. And am I supposed to swear?
You can swear.
All right, we're good.
It's not being broadcast.
All right, it's not being broadcast. All right, sorry about that. I was also there when American soldiers stood by outside of towns in southern Iraq after President George H.W. Bush had encouraged the Iraqi civilians to rise up and overthrow Saddam in 91. And we were there with hundreds of tanks, hundreds of Bradley fighting vehicles, hundreds of Humvees loaded with ammunition outside these towns, ordering the civilians to go back to the towns or preventing them from coming into our lines. That has to do with, you know, what happened. That's my personal story. And when I came back, I didn't want to talk to anybody at all, and I wrote a paper about the war in a class, and the teacher said, "Oh, you need to go talk to somebody," the professor said. So I did, and I went to VA to deal with what it's like to see large numbers of civilians die when you were standing there. So I put all this in context. So when you're a reporter and you've got a story you want to write about healthcare, you want to write about claims, the things that I mentioned earlier, be prepared. See the movie, learn about PTSD and TBI. There's a great website. It's called, oh gosh. Hold on. America's Heroes at War. What's the website? It's the Department of Labor website, and I thought I had it on my cheat sheet, but I don't. It discusses what's TBI and what's PTSD in lay terms. So before you go to the interview, you are prepared with some information. Plus, you've got all the stuff that was here. You can read the Institute of Medicine report about Gulf War and health that says that PTSD is related to deployment to a war zone, not necessarily combat. We want to break this myth that you had to be involved in combat to have PTSD. You don't. Okay? So that's the pre-interview setup. And then the second part is actually interviewing the veteran. I want to agree with Helen Benedict, Kelly Kennedy here, and Dr. Paul, what was her last name?
Yes.
Anyways. Dr. Paula.
Dr. Paula.
You really have to go slow. I really want to emphasize that, because my assumption in giving these suggestions is that this is the first time the veteran might be opening up, and it might be the first or second time you've done the story. Okay? after the second or the third or the 20th story, it'll be old hat, but some of these tips come into play. Rule number one, vet the vet. Here's what I mean. Every service member at discharge receives a DD-214 that lists their military service. It says what they did, where they went, and when they did it. It lists their rewards and stuff like that. You need to learn how to read one of those. Don't do like some newspapers and TV stations have done, is talk to somebody who ain't a vet. Okay, there are phony vets out there. You have to make sure due diligence on that subject. If you have a question about how to read one of those, you can go to DOD and they'll tell you how to read one of those.
What's the form again?
DD-214. That stands for Department of Defense Form 214.
And you get it how?
You get it the day you leave the military.
No, but as a reporter, you get it.
You have to ask the veteran. Okay. If the veteran doesn't have it or they're giving you problems about it, you can actually file a FOIA request for their DD-214 that will be redacted. Okay? And you file whatever form it is with the Personnel Records Center out in St. Louis, okay, to confirm that the vet is a vet. If they can't show you a DD-214, that is a huge red flag. Okay? Is this going to happen? Maybe 1 out of 1,000. Okay? But you have to do it as due diligence. Second is you have to build trust. This may take several weeks with the veteran. A couple of phone calls, a couple of lunches before you ever get into any kind of heavy conversation. Now, for the 1, 2, 3, or 4 of you who are also veterans, I would suggest that you politely self-identify as a veteran, and if you've been to a war, that will open up the relationship faster. Okay. The next is in the interview is something called avoiding triggers. Avoiding triggers means questions that are really loaded, like, all right, how many people did you kill? Yes, there are reporters that ask that question right away. Or what's it like to kill people? Or how did you react the first time you saw dead bodies? Okay, those are trigger questions. Because what you're doing is you're immediately going to a visceral response for the veteran. Try to avoid those direct questions and rather, as Kelly really said, let the veteran spiel. Because they're going to go around and around and around before they finally get to the main point of the story. Now, here's a trick that you have to learn. You have to find out, is the story that you're writing about the veteran related to, and this is my area of expertise, is it related to their accessing VA healthcare? Or is it about their claim for disability benefits? It's really important to understand that from the veteran because most of the time the veteran won't know. I worked on a case where a veteran got a letter from the Veterans Benefits Administration denying his claim for PTSD. He erroneously thought that he could no longer get his 5 years of free health care, so he stopped going. He then got a letter from the military ordering him back to active duty and back to the war. He got a pistol and blew his brains out. Okay? This is why it's really important to get the information right and ask the veteran for documents and stuff and look at the letterhead when the veteran is saying they're having a problem about health care or benefits and see who the letter's from and what the letter's about. Okay? So it's important to develop the story. And then the third part is the post-publication, the third stage of all this. And here's where the hope comes in. Trying to find a solution. You're not a counselor for the vet, so you should have some tips around for referrals. If the veteran in the middle of the story is talking about how he thought about blowing his brains out, you need to know the number for VA suicide hotline. Okay? If the veteran just says he thinks he might need to talk to somebody, you need to know the name and the phone number and the address for the local VA clinic. So here's what I suggest and why I put it at the front of my presentation about what's VA. For your story, try to have a little box, if you're print or online, and if your TV run a little thing at the bottom that lists a phone number for VA suicide prevention or a local organization that might help with claims, Because here's what happens. After your story runs, your phone is going to ring off the hook, okay? With all the veterans who read the story and say, that's me, okay? Where can I go to get help? So if you've put some tips about what's post-traumatic stress disorder, what's traumatic brain injury, what's where can I get help, and you put it in a little box next to your story, instead of the veterans and family members calling you, they're going to call the professionals for help. And then the last thing that happens after publication of the story, a very practical level, is this. You will get lots of other stories. If you write a story about a woman involved in military sexual trauma, what's going to happen next is you'll get some men who will call you about their military sexual trauma. Okay? And yes, it happens in about equal numbers to the men and women, but obviously far different percentages. Women are much more likely to have MST than men, but because there's more men than women, the numbers are equal. So you'll get lots of follow-up tips for your story if your story is credible for the veteran and the veteran community.
Can I add to the trigger question?
Yeah.
It's okay to ask a question. It's just in the phrasing. So if I'm talking to someone, I know there's something specific, a specific thing that happened that brought about the trauma, I'll say, is there an event that sticks out to you? And let them come around to it themselves. If I know that a friend was killed, I'll say, can you tell me about your friend? What was he like? And that'll usually lead to the story. But it gives them a chance to understand that you're interested in the person end of it to the human part of it. So there's ways to ask those questions.
So you're talking about structuring questions in a way that allow the veteran to find her or his own way to the difficult material rather than confronting them with it right away.
Yes, yes.
Right. Kelly, let me put you on sort of a craft spot for a minute because you've done so many of these interviews now. Can you think of an example of an interview with a vet, either recent vet or long separated vet, that you had some hopes for that went badly? And what was it that went off the rails, if anything comes to mind? And there may not, you're a genius, so it may not have been a great interview or so.
Well, when I was working on the book, in this company of 128 guys lost 15 men, and they are close-knit. They were living in this little tiny house, all 128 of them, for 15 months. So they're tight. And when I was working on the book, I would get these angry emails from guys, who the hell are you to write my story, and why isn't anyone, and why haven't you talked to this guy or whatever. And what I had to come to realize is while there's legitimacy in the things that they were saying, there was also some anger behind it that wasn't necessarily directed at me. It was directed at everybody. So pretty quickly on, I had to learn how to deal with that anger before getting into the story part of things. So I would very calmly say, what is it you're worried about? I talked to this guy, and he had really good things to say about you. Address it from a very calm spot from my side as opposed to reacting to his anger, and that happens a lot in these interviews. There have been a couple of interviews where guys just aren't ready to talk about it yet, and if that's the case, sometimes you just have to let it go. When I worked on this series, the Blood Brothers series, there were a bunch of guys who would talk to me. When I worked on the book, some of those guys weren't in a spot where they could talk about it anymore, and then there were guys who could now. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to be open to where people are at in a way that's not generally the case in other interviews. So a lot of the time they'll let you know, but I think you need to also understand that it's not you necessarily, it's just where they're at. So.
And is there an example, can you think of a time of an interview that was set up that you were nervous about or where you expected a lot of resistance, maybe even had experienced resistance before, where something worked and opened up in ways that made you proud?
The first sergeant for the book, for Sergeant Kenny Hendricks, didn't talk to me for the story. In fact, evaded me very, very carefully, wouldn't come anywhere near me. And there were a couple of other people that wrote about this unit, and when it was time to do the book, he called me and said, you were the only one who talked to a bunch of my men. He made sure you had the whole story. And so when I went down to see him in South Carolina, we went out for a beer, and I just set out the tape recorder and asked him a question. He talked for 8 hours straight. 8 hours. And then as he was talking, I mean, he was telling me all of the pieces. He was talking about finding, he was talking about identifying two of his guys by their neck tattoos because there wasn't anything else left to identify them. He was talking about finding body parts down the street. He told me about breaking down and bawling at the end of one of the funerals. He just talked. And he'd get to the rough spots and he would just do this with his fingers and kind of gaze off into space and just keep talking. And one of the things I had to do during that interview was not bawl. I needed to be able to let him talk, because if you show too much emotion, they worry that they're hurting you and they won't talk anymore. And then I just had to shut up and listen. And he went. He went. And that was my hardest interview ever and probably my favorite interview. At the end of the interview, he said, I haven't talked about any of this. And his wife read the book and said, I didn't know. So I think you just have to be ready for them when they're ready. So.
Well, one of the lessons I would take away from that is that dealing respectfully with a denial may pay off in the long run, that clearly this guy thought he could trust you, not only because you had reported well on his comrades, but also because of the respect with which you had dealt with his previous reluctance to be interviewed, mm-hmm. I imagine. So when you're talking to vets, you're really in it for the long haul. You're not just in it for this story. And I would say that probably is even more the case on a local beat or in a local community, where you deal respectfully with someone's denial today, in a year or 18 months or 2 years or 5 years, they may come back at you with something that you didn't know wasn't on the radar. Yeah.
I had a question related to the issue of trust. I am wondering how you best go about verifying people's stories when you have this very fickle relationship and you're trying to build trust, and then you do want to ask them, well, can I see your DD214? Is that it? Yeah. So how are they not going to feel, well, what do you want to see that for? Do you not believe me? What's up? So how do I navigate that but still make sure that they've yeah. experienced what they are telling me?
I've never asked for a 214. Sorry.
Oh.
But how do I make sure this is the real deal?
That's what Google's for.
Yes. here's what I generally do for veterans when a reporter like Kelly or somebody else says, Paul, find me a left-handed veteran who served in Vietnam who lost a right foot. Okay, I'm making that up. And we get requests like that from reporters. If a reporter's working on a story and they say, hey, I need some veterans with some claim problems, we can find a lot in a hurry. And what I generally do before I give the name of the veteran to the reporter is I'll have a chat with the veteran on the phone. And I'll say things like, first, whatever you tell the reporter might end up on TV or in the newspaper. Okay, yeah, I give them a gut check. Okay. Said they might ask to see your discharge paper to make sure you're really you. They might ask to see your VA medical records. They might ask to see your claim paperwork, especially if you've got a complicated Agent Orange or Gulf War illness appeal that's been going on 20 years. They may want to see the actual denial letter to confirm that you were denied by VA. So by having the veteran a little bit prepared, okay, by me, when the reporter calls them up, the veteran generally will have some of the documents ready to go. That's where I'm the broker that you mentioned before. Okay, mm-hmm. When it comes to veterans on a cold story, where the veteran is calling you up and say, "Oh, I was denied care at VA," You generally, you talk to them, you get their story, and then when you're wrapping up at the end, you'll say, you know, we just need to confirm a couple of things. Can you show us a copy of your discharge or show us something from VA? Okay, whatever you've got, and have them show it. And say, it's not like we don't believe you. Okay, what we're trying to do is to make sure if VA says that you were given care on such and such a date, you actually have a letter that says you weren't. Okay, and that's actually just the double-checking, fact-checking stuff of reporting.
Kelly, how do you deal with verification?
I think it's really like any other story. If you're talking to a veteran about his issue or a soldier, probably he's not the only person you're talking to. And if he's got medical records, you're going to ask to see those in the course of the story. It's not necessarily as verification, but what did your doctor say? And you want to see it. I really haven't. I mean, there are definitely guys out there who are faking people out. But I think your gut on a story in general is going to be helpful in that, too. I've never had that happen where it's...
Yeah. I would add, though, that verification is important. I mean, there are false claims of medals. There are false claims of PTSD. There are false claims of having been in combat. I live in Connecticut, and our current U.S. Senator, Richard Blumenthal, did go around, though he was a Marine. He's a veteran. He was in the Marines. But he went around for a while claiming Vietnam service. Well, it was Vietnam-era service, not quite the same thing. And not only in his case did it cause him, you know, some discomfort in the campaign, but there is a kind of industry of overlapping industry of false claims debunkers who also very often are people who are trying to deny the reality of PTSD and other psychological injury of soldiers and are trying to minimize the impact. And when, as journalists, we put out unverified stories, there's a big opportunity for those folks to create more skepticism among the public rather than creating more interest. And I think in the interest of the issues as well as our own sort of careers, verification, but sensitive, delicate verification, yeah, you know, does matter.
And here's why I say this. I worked at the Department of Labor when I got back from the war, and I was what's called a DVOP, Disabled Veteran Outreach Program Specialist, and my job was to help disabled veterans find jobs. And I would go to homeless shelters and unfold the card table, put my Department of Labor sign up, and said, "We help vets." And there would people who desperately wanted jobs at the homeless center who would line up and say they were vets. Okay? And I had to come up with a 30-second litmus test. Oh, what was your MOS? Next. Okay. All right. Does everybody here know what MOS means? I want to see you raise a hand. Okay, but some people didn't raise their hand. Military Occupational Specialty.
Oh, is that what it stands for?
Yo, shush. If somebody asked me, what's your MOS, I say 19 Delta Delta 3, and they go, what's that? And I say, I'm a stupid idiot that was a cavalry scout. Okay? I'm sorry?
That's not your sorority.
Yes. Oh, gosh. No, I didn't think of it that way. But I would also ask, so who did you serve with? Oh, Bob and Jim and Tom, and they're dead. That's not the right answer. If you ask who you served with, like in my, I would say, 7-6 Infantry or 1st Armored Division. Kelly, who were you with?
3rd Armored Division.
Boom. Okay, you're going to get an answer like that. So it's this kind of stuff, and it's going to take a while when you're covering veterans and service members to kind of get the lingo down, and that's why.
So this ties in very much with what we were hearing earlier about culture and language and getting understanding those things, because they also can be delicate ways into the verification issue. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts, queries? Yeah.
Yes, I have a question for Kelly. In the world of clinicians and in the world of chaplains dealing with trauma, there's a term called self-care. And so basically what it's about is, you know, finding ways to process what you've experienced. And to you're carrying that story, but at the end of the day, you need to shed it. What have you encountered, and what do you do to kind of dispel some of what you carry?
I work at USA Today.
That means you've left Army twice.
Well, when I went to Iraq, I'll tell this as quickly as possible, but when I went to Iraq, I was there when these guys lost six people, and a female military police officer came in to help and was decapitated by a rocket-propelled grenade, and just a lot of sort of bad things happened on their tour. When we got back, the photographer I went with never came back to work. He was done after that tour, because after the time we spent with that infantry unit, we went to the hospitals and watched amputations, like scrubbed in for that kind of thing. And it took me a year before I even understood that I was affected by that. And Bruce first met me when I was still out there on that one. But it took me, when I first got home, it took me 3 hours to read the newspaper in the morning. I was blown through stop signs. I just didn't see them. And then for about a year, I was just sad and didn't understand that I was mildly depressed. So it's not PTSD, but it's symptoms of it. And I finally understood it when a friend said, "Kelly, you're not the same." And then it was like something clicked, and I was okay again. But then when I was working on the book, I was delving so deeply into their stories, you know. And like Hendrix, I listened to a story and then went home and listened to the tape and bawled all the way through the tape as I was writing this story. And I definitely was drinking too much while I was working on that. Every time I deploy, I get dumped, which is typical for the troops and for me. There's a lot of different things that you deal with as in this kind of a job. So when I went to Afghanistan this past time, I immediately went into counseling when I came home. I wasn't dealing with any symptoms, because when you first get back, you're so numb you don't even know that you are numb. And this time, it wasn't as bad of a... No, that's a lie. It was a pretty bad tour. We just saw some bad things, someone shot our helicopter and part of the ceiling fell in and the bullet hit like a quarter inch from the engine. And when I got back, I decided that even if I wasn't feeling bad, I needed to talk to someone just to try to get it out. And because it's not necessarily fair to expect your friends to listen to it, because they can't all of the times, and sometimes they can't listen to it over and over again. And so this time I spent probably 5 weeks with a therapist. I have to say that after the second visit, she tried to put me on meds. And I said, can we try talking about this first? And she was amenable to that, I guess. But after about five weeks, I felt like I was okay, and I think that was a smart thing to do this time. And I don't know if I didn't end up with the same issues this time because of that, or if it was just because of my own head I was more aware, or what. But definitely, I try to spend a lot of time with friends. I try to be aware of closing down and of sadness. It's good to know when you're sad and don't quite realize it. I was very good about exercising when I got home this time and while I was over there. And then the other thing that was different this time is the guys in the book. This is the most fascinating thing to me. I was with them for a few days and then I wrote this book about them. And because I was with them on one of their worst days, they kept checking on me to make sure I was okay. And I'm like, I'm a real reporter. You're not supposed to care about me. I was only with you for, you know, a little while. And they reach back all the time to make sure I'm doing okay. And the moms of the guys who died, I hear from them all the time. There's a main character in the book named Denardi, and for my birthday, she made aprons for me. Just like these really sweet things, and that's a support system that I didn't expect, especially as an objective journalist. So I think this trip was a little easier for that reason.
We do have, I want to circle back to interviewing, but we do have a lot of information on the DART Center website about self-care for journalists and about the research that has been done both on psychological injury among journalists, including general assignment local reporters, but also about resilience. And the basic message is that we are a pretty resilient tribe, actually, and that, in fact, our professional role as witnesses, but also especially those of us who put together narrative, that gives us a degree of control over the story that may be protective, is the theory. The numbers of PTSD for PTSD are not as high as you might think except in frontline combat reporters. And a big part of that probably has to do with the protective role of creating narrative and having some control over these terrible stories that we sometimes find ourselves telling. So, yes, over here.
Paul, a question. How long do they keep the health records of the veterans?
Until they throw them away? When they're deceased,
do they destroy them? Or how long are they on the books, say, even with Vietnam or World War II vets?
Okay, I regret to inform you at this time that, as nice as you are, there's a false assumption in your question that the military created a record in the first place. Right? For Gulf War veterans who were exposed to radioactive toxic waste, combat, to oil well fires, to chemical warfare agents, the military intentionally did not keep records. Therefore, they could say years later that nothing happened. So, now, more specific to your question. The military right now, at present, has electronic records and paper records. The electronic records, they're doing a better job of transferring that information over to VA. Okay, they're working on that. In the long term, they're coming up with a single DOD VA record that, once populated by DOD, automatically becomes part of the VA record. That is huge, and it makes up for the errors of the Gulf War and Vietnam War and previous wars where records weren't kept. The disaster is on paper records. I worked with Government Executive Magazine and reporter Bob Bruin, who covers a lot of stuff with VA, on the fact that the military was knowingly and intentionally destroying mental health records for tens of thousands of service members treated in the war zone. It's negligence, it's vicious, it's terrible. Okay, the service member would go in and get counseling, right? And then when they left the military and they were trying to get benefits and say, look, you need the military records to show that something happened to you in the military so that you can win your VA claim and get VA benefits and care, the records were gone. So it's a mess right now. Is it getting better? And the answer is yes. But I say that with one caveat. In combat, and you're a commander, it doesn't matter if you're a medical unit or in a scout platoon, and there's the enemy out there and they're shooting at you, and you have your choice, am I going to write down what happened or am I going to reload and shoot? Okay? You are going to reload and shoot. Okay? So record keeping falls way down here on the list of priorities of what's going on in a war zone.
So, yes.
I answered that well. All right.
First of all, I just want to tell you that this is really interesting, and thank you. I am a local reporter, and a lot of times I am doing a daily story. I don't have 8 hours to sit with somebody. It's a homecoming, and they've just got off the bus, and I've got 2 hours. Do you have any sort of tips for icebreaking? You know, a lot of, for example, military funerals. We do a lot of these, unfortunately. And again, you're on a tight deadline. You haven't met this person. You didn't call them ahead of you. You're coming in cold. And I'm wondering if you have a couple of tips, maybe some rookie mistakes and maybe some, you know, some ideas.
I think it's the same questions. I think it's the same as being a cops reporter. Tell me about the person, you know, instead of how did he die? I think with homecomings, you're a little safer than you are a couple months after they got home. They're so excited to be home. They're like I was, where they haven't quite figured out that it was a bad trip yet. And the guys who want to talk to you will talk to you, and the ones that don't will stay away from you. And the funeral, I think it's like any other funeral. You go in and you be respectful and say, tell me about the person. So.
Yeah, I think, for example, you'll say, you know, obviously, you're happy to be back, but you know, they'll say things really, you know, really sort of short, really not helpful answers. So you'll always get a lot of, you know, I can't wait to have a shower.
You can't have what?
I can't wait to have a shower. That's always, I get that one a lot.
Yeah, well,
you know,
that's
or,
true.
You know, I can understand.
I went 4 months without a shower. Like, you know.
Yeah, but you know, you get these really, and I'm just wondering if you have any sort of ideas to, you know,
what was
I mean,
your job? What did you do over there? Do you feel like, what were your major accomplishments? And I mean, there might be some things that weren't accomplishments, but that's a good way to get them talking and not feel like you're attacking them. What did your unit do? That kind of thing.
One other tip is there's going to be a public affairs officer there. And if you've already established a relationship with the public affairs officer, and they'll give you a heads up that the unit's coming back, and if you can ask, hey, if the unit's coming back, are there a few people you can ask a couple of days before? Do they want to get interviewed? Here's maybe a couple of questions I might want to ask. And then you can pull them aside. And that way they've had a little bit of time to contemplate an answer and come up with something other than, I can't wait to take a shower, or I'm going to go to Disneyland, or I'm going to go get... Right. And right, beer. Thank you. That's seriously. But there's a double-edged sword to working with the PAO. Sometimes they're going to want to find the guy who's, what, glib, and who will want to give you a happy story, okay? And that's going to be fine, and if that's what you want and you're in a hurry, that's what you're going to get. But it's also going to be nice if you've even done more research and have know what the unit was before they deployed and got to know some of those people and followed their story so that when they come home, they're ready to start talking. And I realize that that takes a long time. Okay, but that's the relationship building.
Well, and if you're going to be, look, if you're going to be covering, if you know that covering these homecomings from time to time is going to be part of your gig, right, then you can sort of know that on background, you just need to be following what the unit has been doing so that you'll know what people are carrying with them when they get off the plane. Let me also give you a kind of maybe a framework for thinking about this. One of my colleagues and mentors at the DART Center is a psychiatrist named Frank Ochberg, and he talks about different acts of traumatic experience and different acts of news. And what you're talking about, fast-breaking stories, quick homecoming, is, for us as reporters anyway, it's act one. It's a breaking news story. And it's happening in the present tense. And there are limits to what you can do in act one. Right? You can try to be fresh and imaginative. You can try to do a ride-along with a family on their first day back. You can like do stuff to try to break out of the cliches. But there are limits because it's still a day one or an act one story. But then there's an act two. And the act two can go on for weeks, for months, for years. And part of our job becomes to convince our editors to put act two on page one, to enable us to do those act two stories along with, I mean, and Natalie here has done a lot of that in other contexts and, well, and with war too. I mean, that's a very important formula that can be helpful as you're trying to deal with the frustrations of a breaking news story is to think about, well, okay, what is the act two? How can I quickly build a relationship with these people while I'm covering act one, but think about maybe a longer term aftermath piece that I could do that would be helpful to them and to me. I don't know if that makes sense. Someone else? Stan.
I was wondering, in particular, I think when you're writing a book or if you're doing something, a narrative piece, something that involves a lot of detail, how in the interview, because I imagine someone, they may spill and tell their story for a long time, but they may not have certain details that you need. And so how do you kind of not interrupt, not kind of throw them off, but and also not sort of re-traumatize them by forcing them to revisit details they don't want to revisit, but still get the stuff that makes kind of a really rich narrative?
I do try really hard to do it while we're in the course of that interview. And I think that you don't necessarily throw them off by asking them for more of a detail. You let them know that you're trying to get it right, and I think they do appreciate that. I mean, there's a lot of interviews where I sit there with my mouth shut, but if someone says something that I don't, wait, can you tell me this? And I think it really is better to say it during that interview as opposed to having to go back. But like with the book, it was a lot of guys. So
if I miss something in one interview, I might ask the next guy, so, and then verify it with another guy. So there were lots of opportunities. And with some of these stories, I did something I never did before as a journalist, and that was, here's my book, First Sergeant, please read it and make sure that it's okay before I send it to the publisher. My company commander and my first sergeant both read it, and that was a really hard thing for me to do because I didn't want them to say, come back and say, no, you got it all wrong, and this was positive, and well, they didn't. It was generally overall correct, which I knew, but they also went back and oh, I didn't tell you about this, and they gave me more details. That was the fantastic thing that happened out of it, was I ended up getting more than I had before because they wanted to tell me more, not take away. So that was kind of a surprise. I think that's fairly typical in these kinds of stories, though. And certainly if you're working on a daily deadline, that doesn't work out very well. But with the long narratives, I work with Greg Zaroya at USA Today. I'll hear him on the phone reading something back to especially the veterans who need to be able to trust your story. And just read it back to them, and they'll give you the details. So I don't think that's quite as traumatizing as you would expect it to be. So,
you know, Kelly, related to that, there's a new phenomenon that's starting, and it's also a story tip. There's classes starting at some community colleges and universities where the veterans are starting to write their stories as a form of therapy. If you can find some of those instructors and then find some of the students/veterans who are writing the stories, then they've had a chance to write it, have a professor edit it, go over it with them, because writing the story can be as helpful as actually hearing it first person.
Yeah. That actually reminds me of something I want to ask the two of you. With other survivors of trauma, crime victims or torture survivors or whatever, a kind of standard piece of advice that we often give out of the DART Center is remember that someone had a life before and a life after their whatever it is you're writing about as a journalist, and you don't want to reduce them to a victim. I don't want to reduce them to being traumatized. Is that true as well when you're interviewing vets, or is the military experience that you're covering often so powerful and so bounded that it's hard to get up?
You still have to say who they are. I think especially with military, because the cliche is, you know, you didn't do so well in high school, or you're getting in trouble after high school and you joined the military because you didn't have another option. So I think a lot of the story is, and it can be hard because they're 18 and they aren't quite sure who they are yet, but if you can get at the before and the after, that's definitely a huge piece of it that gets away from the cog in the machine aspect that people complain about. You have to figure out who these guys are as characters, and everything they are is not military, so...
I would also argue it's part of the recovery process for some veterans. I know that friends of mine who are Vietnam, Gulf War, Iraq, and Afghanistan war veterans, that they have a little something somewhere. Like, I'll have Vietnam veterans, and you'll look at their wristband, and they'll carry around, you all know what the Southeast Asia Service ribbon is? It's the Vietnam flag. And you'll see it as a bumper sticker or a wristband or a pin in their uniform. They want you to know when you see them that they're a veteran without walking up and saying, hi, I'm Bob, I'm a veteran. You know, for me, I have a Southwest Asia bumper sticker on the back of my car. It's helped me get out of a couple of tickets. for some, there's this clear identification that's who they are and there's their career. There's the subtle identification with the wristband or a pin. And then there's some veterans that I know where there's the no identification. I still have friends up until recently who were Gulf War veterans who didn't want to tell their children that they were in the war or didn't want to tell them that they were tank gunners blowing up Iraqi tanks. And toward that end, I would suggest this as a book called Gated Grief. That just came out by Lila Levinson. And the book tells her story about her dad. She knew he was a vet, and that's all she knew. And when he died, she opened up his trunk in the basement of their house in New Jersey, and she learned that he was a doctor in the war, that he was in the Army, that he was at D-Day, he was at the Battle of the Bulge. and he liberated death camps, and he was Jewish. And all of a sudden, the world opened up, and now her self-identity is above her dad. So, you know, be careful. You'll get different levels of identification.
And that reminds me of something else. There's one of my colleagues at Columbia, Dale Marridge, a great long-form journalist, is now working on a book that's the flip side of that story. His dad was in the Marines in Okinawa, and Dale has done some research and come to the conclusion that his father participated in war crimes. And his father's dead, so he can't interview him, but he is going around interviewing other comrades. And let's talk briefly about interviewing perpetrators, of interviewing people who not only have done accidentally bad things, which we've heard a lot about over the last couple of days, but who have participated in what would generally be recognized as wrong things. This is part, you know, some vets coming back and getting caught up in crime, and then it turns out they're involved in bad stuff over there, is part of the local landscape. What do either of you think is distinct, special? How do you begin to deal with vets who are perpetrators?
Generally, they won't talk to you. For the book, there were a couple of things that the guys did that I'm hearing about more now that the book is out. They understood while I was working on the book that anything that they said would be in the book. And so there's a couple of things in there that are, I wouldn't say go all the way to the level of a war crime, but that are things that make me uncomfortable. For example, one day they killed an insurgent and they brought him back to the base, sprawled out on the hood of the trunk of the Humvee with everyone cheering. Well, that was enough to make me feel like throwing up. Just, it's wrong to me. To them, it was a way to deal with everything that had been happening to them. There was also a guy in the book who killed someone at close range. The guy's hands were zip tied behind him, and this sergeant shot him at close range, and a couple of the guys in the book were there when it happened. For that, I went back and got the records and read the records and talked to a couple of the guys. I didn't hear from the guy himself until afterward when he said it was a whole bunch of lies and I had it wrong. He sent that letter from jail. those are really difficult, because right now one of the guys involved in the Afghan story where they were killing civilians with the kill squad, I think they called it in Rolling Stone. That's one of my guys. And I've talked to his wife a couple of times, but their lawyer has said, nope, not going there. So if you can get that story, that's great, but it's really difficult to get.
Another one of our awkward fellows, Dave Phillips, talked to some guys in prison.
First off, DOD is blocking access to some mental health care for those who were ordered to torture. And just so we're all on the same sheet of music, yes, the President of the United States did order people to torture in the last administration, and now it's stopping. And here's the blowback from this. The first is that VA and DOD are not prepared to handle what's called perpetrator PTSD. That's where you have enormous guilt and flashbacks of what actually happened and remorse about what happened. I could talk about this at great length because I spent 3 hours with one veteran who was suicidal after torturing people, trying to get him into VA, and we got him into VA, and he sent me a note, thank you for saving my life. That's the stuff that makes my day. But if you want the big picture, write this book down. Read her book. Her book's great. But also read this book, None of Us Were Like This Before, by Josh Phillips. I read it, and, you know, I had to put it down. I mean, I was getting ill reading it, okay? It's that tough. He interviews Iraqis who were tortured as well as U.S. service members who were ordered to torture and who tortured. And that is a gut-wrenching book. And I just say this to put it in context. Our country really does try to be the good guy. 99.9% of the service members I've ever known have really been really good people. Unfortunately, like with this kill squad and with some folks out there who were ordered to torture and then who tortured even though it's a war crime or possible war crime if you get indicted and convicted. I heard a word from a veteran the other day that blew my mind, and it made me read a book. And the word is Einsatzgruppen. Okay? And if you don't know what that word, Einsatzgruppen, it's German, it's the death squads that went around hunting Jews in Eastern Europe during World War II. Essentially, some very small number of American soldiers felt that way, hunting down Iraqi bad guys and torturing them. Okay? And when I heard that, I felt really blanched and sick to my stomach. So I want to let you know, it's a very small number of people.
Two thoughts on this, and then maybe one other question, and then we'll wrap it. I mentioned yesterday, I think, Dave Phillips, who was going to be here this weekend but had a conflict, was a reporter at the Colorado Springs Gazette, who found himself reporting on a series of crimes locally in Colorado Springs, near Fort Carson, all involving vets. And as he looked into it, he found that a disproportionate number of these vets had been involved in court-martialable or other bad stuff overseas, and that, in fact, there seemed to be a link between corrosion, between PTSD, corrosion of character, and their difficulties with law at home. And he did actually he went to the jail and got some of these guys to talk to him after they'd been convicted. And I think that's probably the key, was that because they had been convicted, they weren't in legal jeopardy, so their lawyers weren't standing in the way. Jonathan Shea, whom we've talked about before, visionary military psychiatrist, veteran psychiatrist, has said, you know, people understand that power corrupts. People don't understand that powerlessness can also corrupt. And I think that's some of what's going on here. Back to sort of interviewing in general. Yes.
I just wanted to mention a little bit. You mentioned writing a program here in Philadelphia run by people connected to Iraq Veterans Against the War called the Warrior Writers Project, which has already published one book, and they're working on another one right now. So it's a really good project. The other question I had was, we've talked a lot about PTSD with highly stressed physical combat roles, but have anybody done something on drone pilots and really, quote, pilots, put them in quotes, and immerse themselves with them, or is there any access to those people? Because I would just love to see what a drone, quote, pilot does over like a month
It's a good question. Do you have a thought?
There has been some reporting about PTSD and drone pilots. Guys who, and I think they're mostly male, but there could be some women who are pilots in Florida out of Tampa, and who, as I think someone mentioned earlier, who they work, you know, long shifts, 24 hours, and then they leave and go home and go to their kids. I believe so. They're basically in like controlled cockpits with you know, screens, just watching and piloting drones and issuing, you know, like and working on, you know, kill orders. They get a kill order and identify a target, and then they have to go and deal with the knowledge that they may or may not have killed the right person, and have to wait for the intelligence to come back that it was a civilian or it was the right target. So I think it's limited. I don't think extensive stuff has been
done. Well, and let me put in a plug here. The way, I don't know the answer about whether drone pilots have been studied by clinicians, but I can tell you how to find it. And this is actually for any of you beyond drone pilots. The National Center for PTSD, which is a division of the VA, has its own website. It's based in Vermont. It has nodes all over the country, and they're the top resource for authoritative information on PTSD and PTSD-related research. They have a public database on their website called PILOTS, P-I-L-O-T-S. You just go to the National Center for PTSD website, go to click on pilots, and then you can put in search terms to your heart's content and find any clinical, any research that's been done on specialist populations, not only of vets but other traumatized groups. All trauma research is on pilots. But if you wanted to find, has there been a study of drone pilots, you would just go and put in under other search terms, drone pilots, and see if anything comes back at you. But it's a fabulous resource for local journals, because if you're trying to put your story into some kind of national context, if you're doing something on homeless vets in, you know, in Pittsburgh or something, and you want some national numbers that are authoritative, academically vetted, peer-reviewed research, put homelessness and veterans into pilots database, and you will get the immediate access to the abstracts. You'll find the names of the authors, so you can contact, you know, the professors for quotes or whatever. It's a fabulous resource. Let's end this formal part of the conversation here.